Well, this man I'm going to bring to your attention right now and bring on the airwaves of WTSB needs no introduction. His name is Tom Joyner. He told me something about the CIA and about a gun that they possessed and had in their arsenal. And I also had Carl Gallops, Pastor Carl Gallops, a former law enforcement man. Guess what? He told us about that same gun today, and I don't know whether you heard the broadcast or not, but Carl Gallops, a lawman and also a minister, and Tom Joyner. I'm going to give you a new name here again. Tom Joyner, you are the best. There's no doubt about that. And I'm just anxious to have you on the air with me today, and you got a lot of things to talk about. I'm going to sit down and listen. So you come on in and tell me what the good people of WTSB ought to know about, because I know you know.
Well, last Saturday we learned that Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia had died at the age of 79. He was a conservative, but more importantly, he was a man who followed the Constitution and who did not seek to legislate from the bench. He will be sorely missed. Still, the so-called tolerant liberal community were all over the Twitter and blogs with the most vile language celebrating Scalia's death. Scalia's death does change the dynamics of the November presidential election, no doubt. Barack Obama will try to put another liberal on the court to ensure that the highest court in the land will legislate from the bench. There's also no doubt that the American people must demand that a Republican-controlled House and Senate not confirm Obama's appointment should he try to put one through, and he will. Conspiracy theories always arise when someone of the magnitude of Justice Scalia's death happens. Some are suggesting that Scalia did not die of natural causes, but that he was killed. We may never know, since his body was quickly embalmed and flown back to Virginia. Texas law calls for an autopsy in such situations, but Scalia's family accepted the hasty verdict of a heart attack and turned down an autopsy. Scalia had accepted an invitation to go dove hunting on a Texas ranch owned by a millionaire who was a strong Democrat Party donor. He was found dead in his room. Evolving technology is a good thing, but it also has its downside. We learned in 1975 that the CIA has a weapon, it's a gun, that can be used to kill a person and make it appear to be a heart attack. If they have it, others would have it as well. It's alleged that Scalia was found on his bed with a pillow over his face. If true, what does that mean? Did he experience a heart attack and clutch the pillow in panic? Or did somebody else put the pillow there? Again, we will probably never know, and that's a shame, because these conspiracy theories will last throughout eternity. Scalia was overweight. He was 79 years old, and so he was susceptible to a heart attack. But because of the hasty actions taken after his death, we are all left now to wonder. I have no more proof than you do as to whether Antonin Scalia died of natural causes or from the hands of an assassin seeking to alter the balance of the Supreme Court. Sadly, the highest court in our land is tainted by its members who either lean to the right or to the left politically. Rather than simply interpreting the Constitution without bias either way, predictably, Harry Reid and other devious Democrats attack Republicans for vowing to stop any appointee of Obama's to fill Scalia's seat on the court. Barack Obama was the first U.S. president to vote for a filibuster to stop a Supreme Court nominee. Harry Reid and Chuck Schumer have both been active in preventing the nominations by President Bush in his final year in office. And yet they pretend to have clean hands in demanding that Obama's nominee be pushed forward. Obama, as president, has every right to try and ram through another liberal justice to replace the conservative Scalia. But Congress has every right to block that nomination and to allow the next president to fill the vacancy. The stakes are too high to do otherwise. Let the people of the United States make that decision with their votes in November. the next president should appoint someone to replace Scalia, not a lame duck who's already gone down with all of his power and who has already done all in his power to bring America down, as he promised in getting elected. Conservatives have to put everything else aside and make sure that they vote to keep Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders from the presidency and the appointment of a radical liberal to tip the court to liberal madness. We must not let anything stop each of us from taking the White House power away from radical liberals, which we'll discuss later in the commentary. Our country cries out in desperation. And if we make another mistake in November, the future of our children and grandchildren will be nothing but a memory. I watched carefully the Republican debates in New Hampshire and South Carolina, and several things came to mind. First, politics is an extremely ugly business, and anybody who engages in it has to be suspect. Here's my take on the candidates at this point in time. There's always the possibility that things might change as events unfold, but as of today, here are my thoughts. The South Carolina debate showed an ugly side of Donald Trump, and that gives me great pause. While any one of the Republican candidates would be a better choice than the Democrats are offering us, including Trump, the obnoxious behavior of Donald Trump, especially in the South Carolina debate, was obvious. Calling people names and constantly interrupting them is not presidential. They listened while you talked. You must listen while they talk. Now, it may work in the business world where billions of dollars give him leverage to demean the opposition. But a president without any semblance of tact or diplomacy, not to mention simply good old-fashioned manners, does not bode well for the country. Trump's obnoxious behavior on Saturday night was enough to cause me to drop him to the bottom of my list of Republican candidates, and I don't think the man is capable of change. Now, I share much of Trump's message, and everyone else is free to support him, but he is too over the top for me. Jeb Bush neither helped nor hurt himself that much in the last two debates. I think the country's tired of the revolving door through which a Bush or a Clinton has used to enter the White House. And while I think that Jeb is a good man, I do not see him overcoming that hurdle. Dr. Ben Carson is a fine human being, and I appreciate his stands on issues. But the truth is that he does not have the money or the contacts to win the nomination. And for that reason, I believe that he should suspend his campaign, and I believe he will after South Carolina if he does not go above single digits. The next Republican president would do well, though, to bring Dr. Carson into his cabinet. The man has way too much to offer this country. And that brings us to Ted Cruz. Now, I admire the ability to stand against the status quo. But the political system is set up to punish those who buck it as publicly as Cruz has done. That creates enemies on both sides of the aisle, and no Republican running has that many enemies. Cruz is a smart man, he's an eloquent debater, but he is now third on my list. So my two picks at the moment are John Kasich and Mario Rubio. In New Hampshire, Rubio was bullied by Chris Christie. He fell for the bait. In South Carolina, Rubio came back and showed the vision that we need to undo the fundamental changes of Barack Obama and Obama's efforts to bring America down as he promised to do. Rubio, then, is in the top two on my list, along with Ohio Governor John Kasich. Now, I've had the opportunity to sit and talk with John Kasich, and I find him to be a rational man who brings experience from the national and state levels to the campaign. Anybody who believes that a maverick can go into the White House and make the changes necessary in our country without having the ability to gather support from both sides of the aisle just does not understand what it takes. Compromise has been made a dirty word, and we should not compromise our core principles. But believing one can constantly shout, my way or the highway, and be successful isn't thinking clearly. A Rubio-Kasich ticket or a Kasich-Rubio ticket would be my choice as it stands today. Now, you can think any way you want, and you're free to do so just as I am. But that's my take as of today. I don't let myself get sidetracked by all of the inane charges hurled at one candidate by another. It's childish and beneath dignity. Half-truths and outright lies against an opponent should not divert us. We have to use our heads and not emotions in electing the next president of the United States. The stakes are higher than they have ever been. And the ability for this country to move forward or even to continue to exist hangs in the balance. We have long taken freedom and liberty for granted. We've also felt that our country could always recover from bad management. And fortunately, we have. But like a cat with nine lives, eight of ours are gone. And the last one hangs by a thread. We either seize the moment, deny another 4 years of Barack Obama in the guise of Hillary Clinton, or this country will fall. If you believe that Barack Obama has been a great president, as Hillary Clinton does, if you believe that another 4 years of someone ruling as a dictator, as Obama has done, is best for the country, may God forgive you. For those of us who will suffer from it will not. One thing is obvious. Gilmore, Fiorina, Carson, and Christie needed to bow out of the race long before the New Hampshire primary. They're good people, but there comes a time when we all must realize that our best isn't good enough, and it is the greater part of valor to simply step aside. And that takes us to Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. What a sad state of affairs when that is the only choice Democrats present to us. Bernie Sanders, a 74-year-old socialist who, in his 26 years in Congress, has never authored a single bill that passed. A man who lived on welfare before being elected to public service. He's never met a payroll, and yet he rails about those who do. Sanders honeymooned in Russia, and in 1975 he extolled the virtues of the Cuban communist Fidel Castro. If elected, Sanders would be the oldest president elected to that position in our history. His promises of free stuff adds up to an additional $19 trillion on top of the current national debt of $19 trillion. And Obama's latest budget request for an additional $4-plus trillion, a total of $42 trillion of debt, a figure that would bury the United States. Sanders' popularity comes from pointy-headed liberals and college-age kids who clearly have no concept of reality. In short, his support comes from socialists and the young minds these socialists have brainwashed in public school and in our universities. Thankfully, Bernie Sanders has as much chance of being elected president as Beyoncé has of drawing a crowd without being naked. The Hillary Clinton campaign knows that. The Democrat Party knows that. And that's why Democrats did not and do not fear Bernie Sanders in the long run. What the Democrat Party had not counted on was the arrogance of Hillary Clinton and the resulting FBI investigation of her unethical conduct and extreme lack of good judgment. There is ample evidence to indict Hillary on several charges. Democrats misread the public's mood concerning abortion, and anyone who does not believe that a child is a child fully formed 5 minutes before they're born is delusional. Hillary Clinton believes, as does Debbie Wasserman Schultz, that a baby in the mother's womb just 5 minutes before its birth can be legally murdered. It's one thing that we argue over when life begins, but it is clear, and should be clear to all of us, that a baby ready to be delivered into this world in 5 minutes is alive. Nevertheless, Hillary Clinton condones abortion of that baby. Democrats knew, everybody knows, that Hillary is a serial liar, an unethical human being, and as greedy as Bernie Madoff. But they also knew that the Clintons, Bill and Hillary, had been masters of cover-up for all of their adult lives. that the two of them had been able to destroy evidence of their numerous evil dealings again and again. And so, Democrats put all of their cards into the thought that this time would be no different from all of the others. And that appears ready to backfire on Democrats as the FBI probe into Hillary's email scandal gains momentum and has moved on now to the Clinton Foundation. Many Americans still don't understand how dangerous Hillary Clinton's actions were in this email controversy. Liberals ask, what's the big deal? Well, let me explain it from the beginning in terms that anybody can understand. Barack Obama appointed Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State for political reasons. He doesn't like Hillary, she doesn't like him. Valerie Jarrett hates Hillary, and Bill Clinton hates Valerie Jarrett. But they all know each other and know so much evil about each other that it made sense for them to form a political bond. Hillary knows herself better than anyone else, and she knew that she had to keep her emails close in order to control the evidence, as she has so often in the past, should her private server ever be called to light. So Hillary had a personal email server installed in her New York home, against the laws of government. She knew it was wrong, and even called one of her underlings to task for using his personal server for emails pertaining to government. Yet she kept pretending that our laws don't pertain to Hillary Clinton. When word leaked out about Hillary's personal server utilizing State Department emails, she relied on what has served her so well in the past. She lied, telling us that it was really Bill's server. Bill said no, he didn't send emails. And so, caught in the lie, Hillary then admitted that she had paid a State Department underling to install the personal server in her home. She made no apology for that lie. Any credibility was lost at that point. But the liberal mainstream media still did all possible to distract us from the lie. Hillary then said that she had never sent nor received any emails that were confidential. When it was discovered that many of the emails were in fact confidential, Hillary changed her story again to say that she had not sent or received any emails that were marked confidential. Then the evidence turned up in an email from Hillary to the State Department that instructed them to remove confidential headings and send them anyway. Think on that for a moment. Hillary Clinton, the liberal Democrat darling in the presidential race, instructed that the confidential markings on the emails be left off, and then had the arrogance to fall back on the fact that those confidential emails were not marked confidential. Can she be any more in our face than with that lie? But still, it gets worse. Hillary Clinton quickly moved to erase more than 30,000 emails from her private server. She had them destroyed. Why? If there was nothing incriminating in those emails, why destroy them? They could have exonerated her, but she knew that there were emails on the server that could land her in prison. She moved to destroy the evidence. It's now been determined that more than 22 of those emails were top secret, some so secret that even members of Congress with security clearance are not permitted to read them. Is Hillary Clinton too ignorant to recognize that emails of that sensitivity have no business on her personal server that's wide open to hackers the world over? And they were shuttled around between her staffers who had no clearance to view them? No, she's not ignorant. She is devious. Anybody who thinks that our enemies in China, Russia, and North Korea, among others, did not hack into her computer and have copies of those top-secret emails are kidding themselves, and it's dangerous, not funny. Recently, Hillary said on the campaign trail that she was 100% sure that the FBI investigation was not really an investigation, but a review, and that she was 100% sure that she would not be indicted. 100% sure? That's absolute, folks, and there is absolutely no way that Hillary Clinton could possibly know that unless the fix is in, she's lying again. That means that she's lying again, or that she knows that Obama's Justice Department under Loretta Lynch will ignore any FBI recommendation that Hillary be indicted. If that doesn't bother you, it should, greatly. Now, if you believe that Barack Obama has been good for America, then Hillary Clinton is offering you 4 more years of the same. At every opportunity, she wraps herself around Obama like a drunken boa constrictor meeting Jennifer Lopez. By endorsing Obama, Hillary hopes that he'll put his support behind her. But more importantly, Barack Obama is all that stands between Hillary and the federal indictment. Unfortunately for Hillary, she is despised by Obama's main advisor, the vindictive Iranian Muslim Valerie Jarrett. The emails that Hillary Clinton so cavalierly exposed to the world had, among other things, top secret information, personal information on government employees, including their identity and, in some cases, their addresses. That puts their lives at risk, and in the case of federal agents, it removes their ability to protect and defend us with their cover blown. Now, I hope that those who did not quite understand how important this FBI investigation of Hillary's actions is now understand it. Otherwise, you may go to the polls and vote again for Barack Obama dressed as Hillary Clinton. Bernie Sanders is right about one thing. When Goldman Sachs built their new headquarters building in New York, Hillary Clinton was there with a shovel. She was one of those that dug the dirt for Goldman Sachs. She later received hundreds of thousands of dollars in speaking fees from this Wall Street giant. People in the securities and investment industry, Wall Street, gave more than $17 million last year to super political action committees supporting Clinton's presidential run. And they gave nearly $3 million directly to her campaign. Wall Street is the top industry devoting and donating to her effort. Still, Hillary Clinton wants us to believe that she is anti-Wall Street and that she's going to come after them once elected. What maniac would be giving Hillary millions of dollars if not assured that Clinton is all talk and no action? Lastly, a desperate Hillary Clinton has begun playing the race card and the feminist card. While Bernie Sanders was meeting with Al Sharpton last Thursday, a meeting where one man, Sanders, wants to raise our taxes and the other man, Sharpton, doesn't pay his taxes. Meanwhile, the Congressional Black Caucus endorsed Hillary. That endorsement was as sure as saddle sores on a posse in hot pursuit. Then former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright spoke to a group of Hillary's women supporters and said that there was a special place in hell for any woman who did not support other women. Hillary followed that ignorant remark with a cackling laugh. Remember the communist promise to destroy America from the inside? To do that, you have to divide our people against each other. Obama did it by playing blacks against whites, and Hillary was doing it not only by playing blacks against whites, but playing women against men. Can you even imagine a Republican candidate endorsing a call for men to support only men, or call for white men to vote only for another white man? The media firestorm would be loud and sustained. If you're not ashamed of what has become of the Democrat Party of today, you should be. Now, let me digress for a moment to comment on the halftime show during the Super Bowl. It featured a band, Coldplay, Bruno Mars, and Beyoncé. Anytime Beyoncé is presented, you can depend upon her being as naked as censors will allow, and this was no exception. She danced out, scantily clad, ahead of a contingent of black women dressed in black apparel with the black power salute of clenched fists prominently displayed. They formed the letter X on the field, paying homage to Malcolm X, and then proceeded to denigrate the policemen and women in America. Ironically, this racist woman had enjoyed a police escort to the stadium, which she had requested. The lyrics of Beyoncé's latest album and those before it are raunchy, very raunchy. And if your kids spend money that supports this woman, you should stop the allowance and put them on the Do Not Buy list. What happened on the field at halftime of the Super Bowl points out the hypocrisy of Black America's stands and protests. What if, instead of some 20 black women dressed in black attire with raised fist black power salutes, had instead been white men or women dressed in Ku Klux Klan robes with clenched fists? Self-appointed black leaders like Sharpton, Jackson, and Farrakhan and the Black Lives Matter crowd would have been protesting quicker than a pit bull on a pork chop. Cities would be burning. Stores would be looted. Mindless violence would be carried out against white people who had never even seen a Klan robe in person. The spectacle should have been foreseen by professional football. Invite a bull with diarrhea onto the field, and you can expect bull excrement. Beyonce and her rapper husband Jay-Z were behind the money to send to black rioters as bail money, and they've been highly vocal in their anti-police rhetoric. A full moon eclipse would not be black enough to satisfy Beyonce and Jay-Z's racial feelings. These kind of actions keep us divided along racial lines, and they threaten the security of our country. Whatever happened to singers or dancers who actually had talent instead of poochie-coochie mamas not worthy of a flatbed truck stage at a county fair in Mississippi? Now, I did not intend to go there today, but it's time for white Americans to stop retreating from the truth and for black Americans of goodwill to join them. I refuse to remain silent any longer as black activists and white liberals launch attack after attack on white America, pretending that all problems in black America relay back to slavery or so-called institutional racism. These same black activists and white liberals are responsible for the presidency of Barack Obama. And under Obama, the Justice Department has been headed by racists who ignored public calls for the murder of white people, by demagogues like Louis Farrakhan and the head of the new Black Panther Party. Among others, it is time for white America to say no justice, no peace. That does not mean that we resort to violence, but we do demand an even-handed Justice Department. I'm ready to be called a racist by racists and expect to be, but our government has been hijacked by a Muslim-appealing president and appointees of his who have the color of their skin but no content of character. In 1964, 76% of Americans trusted government to do the right thing, just about always, or most of the time. Today, it is 18%. In 1965, 68 senators and 295 representatives were Democrats. Lyndon Johnson was unstoppable. When Johnson became president in 1963, Social Security was America's only nationwide political social program. The programs he initiated in his so-called war on poverty destigmatized dependency on government. Between 1959 and 1966, before the Democrats' war on poverty was implemented, the percentage of Americans living in poverty had actually gone down from 24.4 to 14.7%. When LBJ and the Democrat Party started the war on poverty, they instituted Medicare, Medicaid, food stamps, disability payments, heating assistance, and a host of other government social giveaways. Those considered in poverty today have DVD players, multiple TV sets, personal computers, and home internet access. Amenities not even the richest U.S. households could avail themselves of when the war on poverty started. 30% of Americans, about 48% of blacks, 49% of Hispanics, live in households receiving means-tested government benefits. The proportion of the men 20 and older who are employed has dramatically and almost steadily gone down since the start of the war on poverty, falling from 80.6% in 1964 to 67.6% 50 years later. For every adult man, ages 20 to 64, who is between jobs and looking for work, more than three are neither working nor seeking work. Family structures have been decimated. We have seen the out-of-wedlock births increase from 7.7% in 1965 to more than 45%, including 75% of black babies. Today we look at the failures of the black community. Black activists and liberal whites tell us that the problem lies in poor police relations and white racism. But the facts don't support that. Thomas Sowell is a black American writer, and he's shown that black families survived centuries of slavery and generations of Jim Crow, where most black children grew up with two married parents. One would be hard-pressed to believe that racism in America today is worse than it was in the past. Here's what happened to the black community. In the 1980s, there were four public schools in Washington, D.C. Three were white, one black. From 1899, the black school, Dunbar High, averaged higher standardized test scores than students in two of the three white schools. From 1870 to 1995, Dunbar repeatedly equaled or exceeded national test scores. Obviously, black parents in that era did not consider it acting white to get their children educated. Every census from 1890 to 1950 shows that black labor force participation rates were higher than whites. Prior to the 1960s, the unemployment rate for black 16 to 17-year-olds was under 10%. Before 1960, the number of teenage pregnancies had been going down. Both poverty and dependency were declining, and black income was rising faster than whites. In 1965, 76.4% of black children were born to married women. There was real pride, not artificial pride, in the black community. By the 1960s, American society was riddled with white guilt. The country overcompensated with those sweeping entitlement programs under LBJ and the Democrat majority. A blind eye was turned to accountability on long-standing values and principles, behaviors within the black community. This destabilization created turbulent neighborhoods and had devastating costs to children, ranging from poverty, education gaps, violence, crime, drugs, and a culture of victimization and feelings of entitlement. In 1980, 31% of all black firstborn children were born to teenage mothers. By 1992, it was 54%. From 1990 to 94, 77% of first births to black women were to unmarried women. Since the 1980s, the majority of black families with no husband present lives in poverty. Today, black people account for 13% of the population. Yet they are the victims of 51% of the nation's murders, and 93% of the murder victims were killed by other black people, not white racists. Less than half graduate from high school. Black males between the ages of 14 and 17 commit murders at 10 times the rate of white and Hispanic males combined. In Chicago, murders are averaging more than 50 a month since January 1st of this year. Almost two a day. In many urban areas, the black illegitimacy rate is well over 80%. Black activists and white liberals march to protest profiling. But when you have such overwhelming evidence to support fear from young black thugs, why would you not want to pay more attention to them? Now, we have to acknowledge that well-intentioned social giveaways have uprooted traditional cultural incentives and legitimized an entitlement attitude that harms children. Stop ignoring bad behavior and life choices in the black community. Discriminating between proper and bad behavior is not racism or bigotry. Stop clinging to a culture that is supposedly authentic in the name of group pride or to avoid self-reliance and personal responsibility. That's not keeping it real, unless one wants to aid and abet in the destruction of black America. Toxic role models that guide children into a culture of destructive behavior must be challenged. Racism is not dead, but it was on life support. It's kept alive by people who use it as an excuse to keep minority communities fearful or resentful enough to turn out as a voting bloc each election day. Think about this. Many, if not most, Muslim children are taught to hate and glorify violence in the name of Allah. Black children, who are constantly besieged to hate whitey, and their life choices are not what keeps them down, but some mysterious white people they have never encountered. they can't help but consider themselves victims. Remember, the poverty rate among black married couples has been in single digits since 1994. Those are the facts. And there's only one group that must be held accountable for the degradation and decimation of the black community: white, liberal, progressive socialists. They found black ministers like Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson, who have placated the black community into advocating its own suicide. Unemployment rates skyrocket, education opportunities dwindle, thanks to the white, liberal, progressive teachers' union. As the black writer Jason Riley said to these white liberals in his book, "Please Stop Helping Us," Alan West said this: "We have a black first lady, Michelle Obama, who instead of talking about Booker T. Washington's three-point agenda of education, entrepreneurship, and self-reliance, has brought into the white, liberal, progressive, socialist message of black victimhood and dependence instead of black success, achievement, and victory. Instead of addressing these horrific statistics in which she and Barack Obama have fostered, that only 25% of black children have a two-parent home, or the sad fact that millions of black children are being slaughtered by abortion and Planned Parenthood, they choose to be the messengers of the white liberal progressives and help keep black Americans on their 21st century economic plantation. It was more than 50 years ago that Lyndon Johnson came up with the brilliant idea of the government giving a check to a woman having a child out of wedlock. But worse, those checks would keep right on coming as long as no man was found in the home. When he launched the war on poverty, LBJ said that Democrats would have, and he used the N-word, eating out of our hands for 200 years. Johnson is long dead, and the hands today belong to a stressed middle-class working man or woman who's tired of feeding those who will not feed themselves, be they black, white, or Hispanic. And finally, we will end racial strife when we all reach out and forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. Walking on eggshells out of fear or perceived guilt, being angry at sins of the past, or throwing money at a problem that only our hearts can solve must end. Carl?
Yes, sir. What a good commentary this afternoon, and Brother Tom Joyner will be back real soon, and Tom, thank you for that commentary today.
Thank you, Carl, and God bless America.
Amen.
The opinions, thoughts, and ideas expressed on today's program were those of the participants and not necessarily those of the staff and management of WTSB.